standing ovation here. Let's go to our ring announcer.
Welcome to the show that brings you all things nostalgia in the world of professional wrestling. It is now time to go Beyond the Bell.
Students, class is back in session, and I'm your professor, your personal ring announcer as well, Sean Beckerman, back to bring you once again all things retro in wrestling. This is your pro wrestling nostalgia podcast known as Beyond the Bell, which is powered by the SNS Radio Network. After wrapping up the highly successful series, the course concluded known as WCW 101, the History of World Championship Wrestling, we now graduate to the next course, ECW 101, the History of Extreme Championship Wrestling. I know this has been highly anticipated since we debuted the 101 series and we started back looking at WCW, and I know I've heard from you fans out there that you were dying, you're clamoring for some ECW history. Here it is. We go in chronological order via chapter to relive the history of the extreme promotion that revolutionized the industry. This multi-chapter series we'll look back at the evolution of ECW. The revolution was born. We go extreme. New owner and talent invade. Mainstream invasion from ECW. The Nashville Network and the death, plus the reunions that were involved with the extreme promotion. Like I said, ECW revolutionized the industry. In the mid-90s, they set the tone for how wrestling was presented in North America. This course covers the entire history of ECW. I am so excited. Get ready, grab your barbed wire bats, your chairs, your Nintendos, and let's get hardcore. But first, it's time to have a hardcore edition of Behind the Mic.
Let's go to our ring announcer.
The main event,
your winner,
by way of knockout, 12 rounds of boxing, let's get your 4-foot tall, triple threat match. Good evening, the world heavyweight champion.
That is unbelievable.
It's Scooter.
All right, hardcore fans, this is the segment that takes you behind the scenes backstage to give you a glimpse, a perspective of what it is like to be a professional wrestling ring announcer on the independent circuit. The Snow Summit is 1 week closer, as I will have the opportunity to present him my new work, my new demo reels of video and audio, to quite possibly garner some interest in TNA Impact Wrestling, to possibly keep my dream alive of being a professional ring announcer in one of the top two major organizations in the world. It's no secret that Al Snow was a part of the hardcore revolution known as ECW. So we played my Al Snow ring introductions, so we're going to stick with the hardcore theme. One of the biggest highlights of my career was the opportunity to announce the hardcore icon, the Sandman, to the ring. Not just because it was the Sandman and his legendary ECW status, which we'll discuss in this course, it was the whole ambiance. And it kind of fits with the Snow Summit because his ring introduction is one of the video and audio clips I will use in my demo package to give to Al, Mr. Snow. The crowd made this ring introduction so special. They were going crazy for the Sandman. It was a smaller arena, so the sound just echoed and bounced off the walls. I had goosebumps on my arm as the legendary Enter Sandman theme played, blasted through their speakers at this independent wrestling event. So, without further ado, let's go back to relive my opportunity to announce the hardcore icon, the Sandman, to the ring.
From Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, weighing at 230 pounds, the hardcore icon, the Sandman!
Tonight, we open up the ECW 101 textbook and start our course with Chapter 1, the years 1992 and 1993 in the history of ECW. We'll find out how ECW became hot stuff. A dangerously successful new booker comes on the scene. And the big two backlash from the evolution of ECW in the early 90s. Throughout the entire course of ECW 101, you will hear retro audio from different eras in ECW history. Also, you'll hear clips from the two major documentaries made by ECW up until this point. The first, which was made by the WWE, The Rise and Fall of ECW, and then the one that was directed by Jeremy Borash and created the Hardcore Forever documentary. So we here at Beyond the Belt would like to thank both documentaries for supplying the audio behind the history of ECW. So get your pens ready, sharpen those pencils, get your notebooks out, and get ready to take extensive notes as the ECW 101 course has begun at Beyond the Bell.
We were like a traveling freak show. And to me, what was special about it was that's how wrestling started, was on the Kearney circuit.
It was an appropriate name, and it came at the right time, and he used, you know, the best songs in rap and alternative and grunge, and, you know, the characters were different. You know, they looked like real people, not characters, really.
When we started the Attitude Era, that attitude came from ECW.
I've never, to this day, worked in a locker room like that one.
If it wasn't for those two and a half, three years that I was there, there wouldn't have been any career afterwards.
We didn't have to worry about Macho Man Randy Savage coming to ECW trying to take our spotlight, you know, because they couldn't do what we did.
You know, back when we were working in front of Jim Thorpe fans, you know, 50 or 75 of them, my checks cleared every week, and suddenly we're wrestling in front of 5,000 people and on pay-per-view to how many, God knows how many thousands more, and the checks start bouncing.
By the time we hit national TV and we're exposed to a national audience, a lot of our best stars were gone to either WCW or WWF, and we came off looking like WWF light.
Never in my wildest dreams, as I said, did I ever think that this thing would turn into the whole phenomenon that it did. Our goal is just to be able to have a couple show, you know, a show a month or a show a week and try to make a little money, have a little fun.
The first show on February 25th, 1992, at Philadelphia's original sports bar, which saw the fledgling Eastern Championship Wrestling pick up the ashes of Joel Goodhart's Tri-State Wrestling Alliance, which was a promotion that was, in a sense, ECW before it was ECW, took place. The TWA had gone out of business only a month before the night of what was to be their biggest show of all. This is where you could say ECW was truly born. From February 25th, the original sports bar, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Eastern Championship Wrestling, the TWA started the hardcore revolution. Chapter 1 starts off with ECW becoming hot stuff. When regional jewelry store owner Todd Gordon founded Eastern Championship Wrestling in Philadelphia in June of 1992, the wrestling world scarcely batted an eye in his direction. There wasn't much hoopla of this new takeover of ownership. the Philadelphia area had been one of the U.S.'s primary flashpoints of independent wrestling. Activity was booming in Philadelphia for several years, but its track record was littered with financial failure. Most recently, Gordon had helped finance Joel Goodhart's bloody local tri-state wrestling, which had folded in February of 1992, just weeks before promoting a much-talked-about Buddy Rogers vs. Buddy Landell match. Gordon's initial ECW promotional formula deviated a little from Goodhart's, and there was no indication that the success of the newly started promotion being any different from its predecessor. After all, the roster seemed to still comprise of the area veterans, including inaugural champion Johnny Hotbody, J.T. Smith, Tommy Cairo, The Rock and Rebel, which I met personally a few months ago, some surfer dude named The Sandman, and others. Also, the roster comprised of 10 years past their prime ex-stars such as Jimmy, Superfly Snuka, and Don The Rock Morocco.
Another big chop to the throat. Caught him. Now this is how he pinned him in the last match. Let's see if he does it again. He does it again!
Okay.
Again, the referee doesn't see it.
The man they named the Dum Dum Bullet falls for the same thing twice. What a dope.
5 minutes, 55 seconds, and still ECW Heavyweight Champion, the Magnificent Morocco!
I'm going to go down there and talk to him.
What are you doing?
I'm going to go down there and ask him what his problem is.
What is going on here? Stately Wayne Manor now is leaving the booth. And there he is going toward the ring. He's heading toward the ring. He's getting in the ring. What in the world is going on here? Stately Wayne Manor has left the color commentary position. He's talking to Snuka. Snuka complaining that his feet were on the ropes, and he's absolutely right about it. It's the second time he's been ripped off that way. What is Wayne Manor doing? He's beating up the referee! Snuka just smashed the referee! Now Manor readies the chair for some reason.
You know, I've always been one of your biggest fans. You can trust me. Have a seat, calm down. We'll get this straightened out. You know, I'm always speaking for fair play and good sportsmanship. You can ask all these people. Now you have a legitimate gripe.
I don't believe this.
To be up to me to be some sort of, you know, some kind of troublemaker or something like that. I would never do that. Because you've always been one of my favorites. Now, if you just relax, I think, you know, you could ask these people. I stand for family values, good sportsmanship. And I'm surprised that Mr. Morocco, being the fine gentleman he is, would pull something like that, but you have a legitimate right. I think we should get ECW President Todd Gordon up here.
You better get somebody up here right now, brother, because if not, something is going to happen very bad, maybe on you and all the rest of these people in here that cheated on me tonight.
Well, Todd Gordon has a lot of respect for me. He looks up to me an awful lot, and I'm sure he can straighten this right out.
All right, here comes Todd Gordon, the ECW president. This is a precedent situation.
Watch this, Jimmy. This guy loves me.
First of all, you're supposed to be over there, not over here. Don't be here starting trouble and instigating something when you don't belong in the ring to start with. Let me tell you something. I don't overturn any referee's decisions. When the referee says, goes, you're out of here.
Oh, Todd doesn't know how lucky he got it. Manor was going to smash him with a chair. Snuka thankfully puts an end to that. And the fans are applauding Jimmy Snuka for that. And so is Todd Gordon. Excellent move on the part of Snuka. And if Stately Wayne Manor doesn't watch it, he's going to get his.
You, let me tell you something.
Uh-oh. Get him off of him! Get him off of him! What is going on? Snuka's strangling Todd Gordon here. Oh no. Oh no. 20 and a backbreaker. Todd Gordon isn't a wrestler. no! Concord is no, oh no. Oh, I don't believe what I knee drop on the top court. I don't believe this. I don't believe it. He looks like he's going for the super fight on Todd Gordon. This is incredible. It's incredible. Get him out of the ring. Get him out of the ring. Todd Gordon may already be seriously hurt. And now he comes down on Jannetty. Wayne Manor, what have you started here? Todd Gordon isn't a wrestler. What have you done
in the ring? Jimmy Snuka going out of his mind, and it's not a long journey to get there.
He's beating up four people, including the referee and Todd Gordon. Todd Gordon may be seriously injured.
That would be a shame.
I don't even want to sit next to you after what I just saw here.
You know, Todd's a very close personal friend of mine, and I can't believe he turned his back on me like that. If I was trying to settle that
you
argument here...
You were going
to
smash him with a chair when he turned his back on you.
I was just getting it out of the ring. There goes our ring announcer as well.
The ring announcer and the timekeeper have been belted. Snuka is just going wild. If I was a fan, I would not get up out of your seat right now. Snuka's a wild man. I'm sitting next to Scum and Stately Wayne Manor. I can't believe what's going on here. I can't believe what's going on.
I can't believe the reaction I got. I was trying to clarify a situation here, a problem in the ECW. Because, you know, I am Mr. Fair Play. You know, if there's anybody that personifies good sportsmanship, it is, of course, it's Stately Wayne Manor. And I was just trying to help things out here.
I'll tell you what, fans, I smell a rat, and I think the rat's sitting right next to me, and we'll be back.
And although its product was entertaining from the first, its creative direction featured little that distinguished it from the other floundering independent promotions throughout the country, other than really its goriness. It seemed like your regular homegrown independent wrestling promotion. However, Gordon had an ace up his sleeve on this go-around, and at an early 1993 card at Philadelphia's Chestnut Cabaret, it manifested itself in the form of a late hardcore wrestling legend, the embattled Hot Stuff Eddie Gilbert. At the time, Gilbert was both one of the brightest bookers and one of the most talented performers in the business. But due to his headstrong nature and unstable reputation, he had worn out his welcome nearly everywhere else. ECW, though, had little to lose by taking a chance that Gilbert would be on his best, most productive behavior. Gordon immediately granted him full creative control of the company.
Welcome to the ECW Arena in the heart of South Philadelphia for another exciting edition of Eastern Championship Wrestling. My name is Jay Sully. I'll be bringing you all the play-by-play action this evening, along with my official co-host, the color commentator for the ECW, Mr. Stevie Wonderful.
That's right, Jay Sully, and what a lineup we have for you tonight.
Jimmy Superfly Snuka is going to put the TV title on the line against Road Warrior Hawk.
The most dangerous, Paulie's a friend of mine, the most dangerous match between the ECW TV champion and the former one half of the tag team champions, Road Warrior Hawk. What a match right here tonight.
The ECW tag team champions, the Suicide Blondes, have a big grudge match against the former champions, the Super Destroyers.
That's right. Suicide Blondes against the Super D's, who are now, I guess, the number one contenders. I don't get it.
Eddie Gilbert's got a Texas Chain Massacre demonstration this week, Stevie.
You know, we're trying to do an opening, and we got the man right here who's causing all the commotion. From the Road Warriors, we'd like to give to you right now Road Warrior Hawk.
Thank you, brother. You know what I like?
What do you like?
I like the fact that here in the Eastern Wrestling area that we have all the rebels, all the guys who didn't want to take all the bull from all the promoters. All they want to do is fight for a living, not fight with the promotion. And I tell you no one thing about me, besides the elevator not going to the top, There ain't no elevator. It's an empty shaft. You know all I am. You know you like me, but you don't know why. Goodbye.
Wow, Road Warrior Hawk. Incredible. And let's not forget, Stevie, we've also got the debut of a newcomer here in the ECW this week, the Dark Patriot. He'll be facing off against Terry Funk.
You know, it's not a quiz right off the bat. It's the final exams right off the bat. Dark Patriot, Terry Funk, right here.
All right, fans, we've got to get out of here. But let's go to break, and we'll be back. And the first big matchup, it's going to be Hawk of the Road Warriors versus Jimmy Superfly Snuka for the TV title. We'll be right back.
You know what, Superfly Jimmy Snuka? Road Warrior Hawk comes into the ECW. He says he is the biggest. He says he is the baddest. He says he is the meanest, not just here in Philadelphia, but all across the land. You know what I say, Road Warrior Hawk? I say your mama. I say you're not mean enough. I say you're not tough enough. I say you're not rough enough to step into the ring with the ECW TV champion, Superfly Jimmy Snuka, because the bigger they come, Superfly Jimmy Snuka, the harder they fall. Hawk comes out here. He says, hey, we don't fall so often. But you do fall. Isn't that right, Superfly?
You know, brother, you tell them like it is. Hawk, you just stay out of our business, brother. Do you understand? If you know what I'm talking about, well, you put yourself in the first step before you make the wrong move. Woo!
And the first wrong move you made was signing for an ECW TV title match with Superfly Jimmy Snuka Hawk. What we have in store for you, my man, I feel sorry for you.
Wrestling fans, the challenger from the south side of Chicago. He weighs 267 pounds. This is Road Warrior Hawk! Now I would like to introduce the manager, Mr. Paul E. Dangerously! From the Fiji Islands, weighing in at 252 pounds, the ECW Television Champion, Jimmy Superfly Snuka!
TV title match.
I can't believe we're looking at Road Warrior Hawk against the ECW TV Champion, Jimmy Superfly Snuka, on the very first match of the night.
Incredible, Stevie Wonderful. Look at these two competitors. Both these guys are ripped. What shape these athletes are in.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Jimmy Snuka, the TV title holder here in the ECW. He's held that belt for a number of weeks now, Stevie.
Well, this is his greatest challenge to date in Road Warrior Hawk.
Absolutely. Look at the power of that Road Warrior Hawk.
Within weeks, Hot Stuff quickly reaffirmed his vaunted creative reputation by helping ECW continue to become one of the most prominent indie promotions in the country. Not only did he contribute his own considerable wrestling and interview talents to the product itself, but he also capitalized on the extensive connections he had during his 14-plus years in the business. He recruited a litany of big-name performers such as Shane Douglas, Abdullah the Butcher, Stan Hansen, Road Warrior Hawk. They had all joined ECW by mid-93, and the legendary Terry Funk, who had already been accepting sporadic bookings from Gordon, soon became a company fixture. Gilbert's most important recruit, however, was his old WCW and Memphis buddy, Paul E. Dangerously, a.k.a. Paul Heyman, who dropped anchor in Philly in March of 93. Upon his arrival, Heyman formed the short-lived New Dangerous Alliance, which consisted of Gilbert, Snuka, Morocco, and the Dark Patriot, which was Eddie's brother, Doug Gilbert.
You know something, Dark Patriot? Terry Funk comes in here. He says he's a living legend. He says he belongs in the Wrestling Hall of Fame. He says he is one
of the greatest athletes in the history of mankind. What you don't realize, terrible Terry Funk from the Double Cross Ranch, is that this man, Plain, doesn't care about your reputation, about your myth, about your legend. This man's claw hold, when properly attached to your skull, is going to squeeze your brains right through your miserable, stinking Texas eyes. And then, Terry Funk, after he's done with you and he sticks that size 16 boot right down your throat, Hall of Famer, legend, I promise you one thing. When you go back to the Double Cross Ranch in Amarillo, Texas, the Dark Patriot here will make sure that you have one full colostomy bag.
Todd Gordon, come here. Come, my friend. Just a minute.
ECW President Todd Gordon in the ring.
I would like to ask you to have tag me up with those two big guys. Me, him, against the crazy blonde, the dumb blonde over there.
This Saturday night is the Super Summer Scissor Spectacular. Right here, this Saturday night, June 19th. You want a tag team match? Three against three?
Yes.
You against the Suicide Blondes?
Yes.
You guys want a match with the Suicide Blondes? Okay, Saturday night, Super Summer Spectacular. Right here, June 19th, three against three, a six-man tag. What do you say?
Three against three and a half. The manager is only half.
You want the manager in the ring? You want Hunter Q. Robbins in the ring to wrestle?
Yes.
This Saturday night, Hunter Q. Robbins III and the Suicide Blondes, four against three, right here. Don't miss.
Sweet, nice, innocent people of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Well, please just excuse me a second, but I had to come outside just once again and go down into the woods as far as I could before I really felt low. Felt so dirty, kind of like a redneck from Texas, the way that Terry Funk feels every day of his life when he gets up in Amarillo, Texas. Well, Terry Funk, you've come on this television, you've come on Sports Channel, and you've made fun of me. But this Saturday night, chump, I'm going to shut you and all the people of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania up. Because, see, the people of Philadelphia have long been waiting for a hero. They've gone out to the Phillies games just like me, and they've sat with their head down. I even went and bought a ball cap hoping that they do good this year. They're the worst team in Phillies history. They can't even get a home run hitter. They can't get anyone, but maybe, just maybe, after Saturday night, they're going to sign up. Moi. Hot Stuff Eddie Gilbert, the new king, the only king of Philadelphia. This Saturday night, I will be crowned officially the king of Philadelphia after I beat you. You has been washed up, no good for nothing, Terry Funk, because I'm going to take you from corner to corner, pillar to post at the ECW Arena Saturday night, brother, and no one, not even your mama, is going to recognize you with all that blood covering your body. So people in Philadelphia, when it is over with, bow down to your new king of Philadelphia this Saturday night.
Wrestling fans from Portugal, he weighs 183 pounds, Hervé Renesto. First, I would like to introduce the manager, Mr. Paul E. Dangerously.
Excuse me, do it right, ladies and gentlemen. Or you people of Philadelphia, I give to you your king, Hot Stuff Eddie, the king of Philadelphia, Gilbert! Now that's how it's done.
Back here at the ECW, fans, we've got a Texas chain match demonstration, Stevie Wonderful, with Eddie Gilbert.
It's all leading up to this Saturday night, Jay Sully. June 19th, 7:30 bell time, Texas chain. What do we got?
Paul, listen, I don't.
You
I
care
don't
to explain to me why?
Anything about you and I discussing the Dark Patriot?
You know, King, I was just thinking about you and
wait a minute. Wait a minute. You know I don't like this guy.
He'll be okay.
I don't like the Dark Patriot.
The Dark Patriot told me before the show, he said, Paul E., Eddie Gilbert is the king of Philadelphia. That's what he told me. He's all right. I cleared it. I checked it out. Let me make the decisions. I told you. I know what's going on.
Ready, referee?
Okay.
the King of Philadelphia. What's that crown doing in the ring, Stevie Wonderful?
The self-proclaimed King of Philly, Hot Stuff, Eddie Gilbert, in a tune-up Texas chain match against Hervé Renesto.
Well, Hervé Renesto, I don't know. He sure is a Terry Funk, Stevie Wonderful. And this Saturday night, June 19th, you'll see Eddie Gilbert in a Texas chain massacre match. Terry Funk, Eddie Gilbert, this Saturday night.
That's right, right here at the arena. The rules of this match, Jay Sully, which I'm sure you don't know, is that you must be dragged from post to post like a whipped dog, and you must tag each post in succession.
Do you have to drag your man around by the neck, by the chain, Stevie? Is that part of the deal? Is that what you're supposed to do?
Gilbert also wasted no time in intensifying the hardcore elements that had already begun to differentiate ECW and earlier Tri-State from the family entertainment style of WCW and the WWF. While growing up, Hot Stuff had weaned on the wild violence of the early 70s Memphis wrestling. He also recently toured at the time with the notoriously bloody FMW promotion in Japan. Drawing heavily on those influences, he implemented degrees of bloodshed and sexuality, the likes of which no wrestling product had ever contained or even seen on television.
You know, being from Texas, I've dealt with about every kind of animal and varmint that there is in this world today. And that goes from rattlesnakes to coyotes to vermin to just about anything you want to speak of. But I've never ran into a lowlife like Eddie Gilbert before. And you people here in Philadelphia, you know how to spot a good wrestler. You know what ability is, and you know who's got it whenever they go in the ring, whatever it might be that makes them the best. Well, Eddie Gilbert doesn't have that. You know, he just keeps on blowing off and talking big and trying to really, really be somebody. Well, he's trying. And now he's got the opportunity to be King of Philly. Well, I do too. So we're going to find out who's going to get that crown and wear it. But there's only one thing that Eddie Gilbert better give a whole lot of thought is the type of match that he's coming into, because it's my type of match. It's a Texas chain match massacre. He's accepted the match, and now he's going to have to deal with me. And I'll tell you, you know, I've told people before, I'm meaner than a rattlesnake, tougher than shoe leather, more dangerous than a hollow-eyed score pine, middle-aged, crazy like a fox, and all that stuff. And I am, truthfully, because I wouldn't have lasted as long as I have in the professional wrestling business. And I intend on being in it a lot longer. And I intend on being on top in Philly, because y'all are something near and dear to my heart. You fans out there. Because what you are is you're hardcore fans. Because wrestling here in Philly is different. You've seen it all. You've seen the best, and you've seen the worst of it. And now you're going to have a chance to see the most violent of wrestling matches with myself against Eddie Gilbert in a Texas chain match. Hot Stuff? I don't think so.
This Saturday night, street fight, cat fight.
Tick, 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 tick. Rebel, can you hear that ticking in your brain? I'm going to bust your head with a chair Saturday night, Rebel. It's not going to be pretty. There's going to be blood. There's going to be broken bones. And it's me and you. And Tiger, this is what you got to worry about.
Honey, you better not even show up, because I'm going to rip every hair out of your stinking head.
This Saturday night, street fight and a cat fight. Be there, fans.
Gilbert himself was one of the foremost blading connoisseurs in the business, and the bloody torrent that highlighted his ECW matches with fellow hardcore heroes like Terry Funk and Abdullah the Butcher were the backdrop of some of the Philadelphia crowd's very first We Want Blood chants. In addition, in one of the defining moments of early ECW history, Gilbert appealed to the more risque portion of his audience by employing a pornographic actress named Angel, who is known to have starred in The Virgin Princess. She removed her blouse at a cart in Philadelphia in late 93. Before long, the ECW troupe had garnered a reputation as the most brazen, bloody, and risque group in the business, and an influx of local fans began turning out specifically to witness the hardcore spectacle. To the surprise of no one familiar with his erratic history, Gilbert's celebrated stint in ECW proved to be short-lived. In September of 1993, he had a backstage quarrel with Gordon and responded by doing an infamous in-ring shoot interview in the middle of a card. Unbeknownst to anyone backstage, the incident effectively ended his association with the company, and he headed to Puerto Rico shortly thereafter. Tragically, he died there on February 18, 1995, a full 2 years before ECW began its full-fledged national expansion. Some of the names of those early days included Jimmy Snuka, Johnny Hotbody, Don Morocco, Tito Santana, the Super Destroyers, Larry Winters, Tony Stetson, Glenn Osborne, CN Red, Jimmy Jannetty, Tommy Cairo, and Don E. Allen, who I had the opportunity to do commentary with a few years ago. Nevertheless, Eddie Gilbert was no longer associated with ECW. That leads us to part two of chapter one. The ECW 101 course rolls on here at Beyond the Bell. Part two of this chapter involves a dangerously successful new booker arriving in ECW.
I knew Paul Heyman since he was a teenager. He used to be a photographer. If you were shooting a picture, if I was taking a picture, I saw the picture that I wanted to take that shot of, and I got the camera up and I was ready to shoot. Elbow! Psht, Paul Heyman. Me, George Napolitano, and this other photographer, Frank Amato, were plotting, and we were never able to do this, to get him banned from ringside.
I saw the brilliance in him, and I said, this is the guy I want to hang on to. It would really help me make this company grow.
He also kind of rubbed people the wrong way because he felt he had an understanding. And when you're working for somebody else and it's their vision, you have to do what they want. And Paul had a little trouble with that.
You never knew what he was going to do next, but it always worked. And the guys trusted that part of his mind.
Intelligence borders insanity, and if I ever seen anybody that fits that description, it's Paul.
I meet bumped heads a couple of times. I tell you, Paul, he's around the car with a knife a few times. Yeah. He was mad at it. What'd you say? Get the knife.
I care what anybody said about Paul. Paul was one of the best motivators in the world. I mean, like Newt Rockne kind of motivator.
Paul's one of those guys that you can be mad at him, and you want to punch him in the face or put a gun to his head, and you go and you're like, I'm going to kill him, and you 30 seconds after talking to him, you're like, God, he's the best. I love him.
An insane, crazy, Einstein type of moron.
You definitely could see that this was going to be the beginning of something special, and that Paul was bringing a special approach and a different approach to the product and to American wrestling. And you could also tell that every rule that's been written, he was determined to break.
So I didn't really see the significance of what was happening as it was happening, you know what I mean? But looking back on it, it was revolutionizing the business from your cartoon character to, let's say, your everyday guy that sits at the end of a bar, drinks a beer, loses a game of pool to you, and then wants to beat you over the head with a stick.
Paul was definitely making a statement when the very first match on Ultra Clash was Bad Breed against Public Enemy, and nobody knew who Public Enemy was. And they basically squashed Bad Breed that night, and, you know, they bloodied them, and it was definitely clear that, okay, these are the new guys, and these are the guys to pay attention to, and these are the guys that are going to change things.
Because I saw the blood and the violence and the interviews with the balloons with the wig on, and they called him Ric Flair, and I was thoroughly entertained laughing with that, and then just fascinated by the violence and the gore that they did. So there was depth to the characters.
Rocco Rock, great friend, Johnny Grunge, great friend. Rocco, I wish you were still here with us, but you guys helped pave the way.
There was no Paul came in quietly and, you know, eased into things. It was just, boom, I'm changing the product, I'm changing the scenery in the United States, and I'm changing all the rules. And that is exactly what happened at the very beginning. And a lot of that was Sabu. I think that Sabu does not get the credit, or he is just now beginning to get the credit that he deserves for being such a huge part of that change. I don't think that everything that Paul did or ECW's growth would have been nearly as successful without what Sabu did back then.
Sabu was like, boom, major cultural icon in the indies almost immediately. It was almost like a complete revolutionary style of what is this guy doing.
He should have made millions in this business for being as innovative as he was, you know what I mean? And it's a shame he didn't.
I admire him. His commitment and his sacrifice to what he loves.
Greatest performer, greatest creator of new maneuvers that in the last 40 years in the wrestling profession. So many things that he created and started doing that he is the true innovator in professional wrestling.
In 1993, Todd Gordon was ready to take things up a step with Sports Channel Philadelphia. Previously, ECW only had exposure to low-power TV clearance such as W07CB, Channel 7, viewable in Center City and West Philadelphia only. They brought in Eddie Gilbert to book with Brother Doug. With Gilbert also came Terry Funk, who had recently done an interview in the Pro Wrestling Torch about his idea for a hardcore-style wrestling TV show. Along with these two came well-known loudmouth manager Paul E. Dangerously. How little we knew or suspected what was yet to come. The first TV taping was at Cabrini College on March 13, 1993, before about 60 people. This small crowd came despite a snowstorm that dumped 2 feet of snow on Philadelphia the next day. The Texas Chain Match Massacre with Terry Funk versus Eddie Gilbert on June 19, 1993 was the first ECW show sold on tape commercially, with what was then the largest crowd in the Young promotion's history. These two gave the fans at the arena an old-school all-arena bloody brawl, which was not seen anywhere in Philadelphia. The closest comparison, you would say, would be Gilbert's own program in 1991 with Cactus Jack in the ECW's predecessor, the Tri-State Wrestling Alliance. No one saw any type of bloody hardcore action since that 91 encounter in Philadelphia. Paul Heyman, who was already one of ECW's central creative contributors during Gilbert's tenure, immediately assumed the vacant head booker position. To say he was successful would be an understatement of many proportions. Heyman's first major coup was his signing of Sabu, at a time when few fans had ever seen a plancha through a table or a barbed wire-covered baseball bat chairs and tables match, the homicidal, suicidal, genocidal madman's death-defying stunts and barbaric brawling had already garnered him a sizable cult following.
This one day, this guy Dennis Carluzzo told me to call Todd Gordon. He was a sucker, and that I could get $500 from him. And so I called him. I didn't have the guts to ask for $500. I asked for $300, and he said, "Yeah, you get $300. Come on in." And it happened to be the same day Paul Lee was there. It wasn't Paul Lee bunged me in, or someone had a master plan of bringing me in to pop the town. We just happened to be in the same place at the same time. He actually said, "What are you doing here?" I go, "What are you doing here?" And he goes, "Oh, okay, boom, boom, boom. You want to work with Taz?" I said, "No, but I will." I didn't know who Taz was. I never met Taz before then.
The original gimmick, which I believe Sabu hated, even though it was a fantastic gimmick, was Sabu was tied to the gurney, and he had the Hannibal Lecter mask on.
The gurney thing was his idea. He was talking about it before I met him over the phone, and then when I came in, he goes, "You want to do that Hannibal Lecter thing?" And I laughed at him. And some guy came up to me and handed me these masks, Hannibal Lecter masks. I started laughing. I said, "It's a fucking joke." So I threw him away. And he goes, "No, I want you to try it." I said, "No." I said, "I thought you were joking." Over the phone, I was just agreeing with him because I didn't have to, I wasn't faced with it, you know. I thought I'd never be put in that situation. So I actually did it because Jim Crockett was there.
It was almost like a cartoonish gimmick, except for the fact that Sabu was so extreme, for lack of a better word, that there's no cartoon in it.
He goes, "I'll give you $500 if you just do it one time." So I did it, and it worked.
I remember the first time when they unchained Sabu, and Sabu just went, he didn't even go to the ring. He went straight into the crowd, started throwing chairs everywhere.
And then the next day, he goes, "Do it again." I said, "No." He goes, "I'll give you $500. You do it one more time, never have to do it again." I said, "All right." So I did it again. And then it got to be where I couldn't go without it. You know, then I got mad, and then I stopped doing it.
Didn't like it?
It was too much work. You know, it was too much acting. I'm not really that way. Unless there's a certain situation that makes me that way. I can't always be that way. Every time you see me, I'm going wild. When do I rest? I mean, fuck.
Sabu was a huge innovator. I mean, nobody went through tables. Nobody did moonsaults. Nobody got fucking color like that. Nobody used their body as a fucking,
as a human, you know, as a human wrecking machine.
Usually when my uncle got done with the match, he went around and scared other people, and I kept the people away from him. And he said, get back in the ring and get your heat. And I go, how? He goes, think of something. So I said, how about I moonsault the table? And he goes, what's that? And I go, I'll show you. And then that's how it started.
Before he was using a table in his matches and stuff like that, he just, at the end of the match, he just went up on the top rope and started moonsaulting the table, and he didn't break it. And I'm like, oh my God, what is this guy doing to him?
Then when I didn't do it, people were disappointed, so I had to do it. And it was killing me every night. It killed me more when there was nobody on the table than when there was, you know, because my knees would crash to the table. And then if it didn't break, I kept doing it over and over until finally it broke. But I did that for years before I even came to ECW.
In 1994, you did not see anything like Sabu at all in wrestling. So Sabu was kind of the lure to bring you into ECW.
When Sabu started doing all that stuff with the tables and stuff like that, that to me was the beginning of ECW hardcore.
Right at home amidst the chaos and carnage found in Philly, Sabu quickly became the group's biggest star. He captured the ECW title almost immediately upon his arrival, winning said belt from Shane Douglas on October 2nd, 1993. Thus, the phenomenon of table breaking was popularized in United States wrestling. Heyman demonstrated his creative ability most impressively when he tapped into the potential of local indie talents who had demonstrated very little star ability. For starters, he packaged longtime indie standout Ted Cheetah King Petty as Rocco Rock, with New York indie wrestler Mike Durham as Johnny Grunge, he dubbed them together the Public Enemy. They soon emerged as the company's most popular and accordingly most violent tandem. He marketed a short, stocky, face-painted New York indie light heavyweight named the Tasmaniac as a wrecking machine with legit tough guy credentials. This was thereby exponentially increasing the popularity of the future Taz. Another young Northeast indie hopeful named Tommy Dreamer entered ECW and, before long, achieved great success as Terry Funk's hardcore apprentice. A large green rookie named Al Pollig changed his former name from Tombstone to 911 upon arriving in ECW. He emerged as one of the most overperformers in the company. And last but not least, the lackluster surfer dude Sandman became the colorful, beer-guzzling, chain-smoking, blood-letting, weapon-wielding, chauvinistic male pig Sandman, the soon-to-be hardcore icon.
I was getting booed. I was a babyface doing running and getting heat. Not heat because you did something that they hated. Heat because you sucked.
Obviously, my relationship with Sandman was unique, so I guess seeing him evolve to a guy who came out smoking cigarettes and drinking beer, which Paul and I warred over until I finally won, because I said, it is still my money.
And Todd's like, listen, well, why don't you just go out and let him be hacked? You know, Paul's like, what do you mean? He goes, well, it started out with a cigarette. He goes, let him go out with a cigarette. So for a couple months, I just came out with a cigarette. And then I would sit in the back. I'd have a 30-pack of beer. I'd be drinking beer. And then one day, Todd got Paul to let me come out with a beer. And then the Sandman character was really hitting, you know what I mean?
You can relate to a man who walks to the ring drinking beer and smoking a cigarette.
He'd be one of the guys my uncle would like who I wouldn't imagine my uncle would like because he drinks and smokes. But see, that's him.
I love Sandman. One of the smartest guys I've ever met. Now, when I first met him, I thought he was just a drunk. I mean, I thought I was a drunkard when I got there. But, you know, here's a guy with a gallon of milk in one hand, a bottle of vodka in the other, and a case of beer constantly going. But as I got to know him, I found I'm just a brilliant guy. And Sandman and I would often hole up in a room, and people would think we were probably up to all sorts of debauchery, but we really weren't. We'd sit in a room all night and play the equivalent of Jeopardy or something. So instead of screwing rats and doing drugs like everybody probably assumed we were doing, a night of me and Sandman hanging together was,
yo, red guy, I want you to think of a country below the 38th parallel, and it's a dictatorship.
Czechoslovakia.
Perfect! How'd you know that? Okay, what was the dictator's name? Ceausescu. Red guy, how'd you know that? Perfect!
Sit up and play trivia all damn night, but really smart guy, a lot of love for the game, and He's a guy I'd take a bullet for. I love it.
I think he's trying to pickle himself. I don't know. You could put him in a mason jar and he'll last for years.
Sandman is the prototypical functional drunk.
And you know what the interesting thing is? Tremendous family man. Like, you know, a drunken menace to society on the weekends. During the week, he's like the greatest dad you ever saw. Doesn't drink, sits at home, you know, with his kids. Just a phenomenal father. I mean, complete dichotomy.
Sandman is the first man that I've ever seen walk into any wrestling business and have absolutely not 1 ounce of wrestling ability. None. And get over like he does.
Now I love Pac, like, to death. But there was a time that if I had a gun, I would have shot him between the eyes. And we always talk about it. Like, remember when we hated each other?
He'll give you the shirt off his back if he had to. If he needed it, he'd give it to you.
And he's one of the alumni of the VCW. And once again, I ain't got a bad word to say about him. Alcoholic, drug addict, but not other than nothing.
I'm looking for something different to do. Nobody else comes through the crowd, you know what I mean? So I was just looking for something different to do. So I would come out from different places in the building, you know what I mean? Instead of everybody looking down the runway, I'd like to come in through the front door.
If you've never seen the Sandman entrance in ECW Arena, you're missing out on something really special.
When his music came on at Enter Sandman by Metallica, the whole place came to its feet and this electricity came.
And then you just look at the sea of people all start to turn around. And it like flows across the building. Everybody turns around to see. And then you stick your cane up and then the place explodes, you know? It's a great, great feeling, you know? Terry Funk again, kid, you gotta do something different to separate yourself.
Sandman is the drunken fans with a cigarette in their mouth, drinking and smoking cigarettes. Tommy's like the actual, you know, is like the Mark fan that could never do it. And Sandman's the drunken guy who sits on his couch and goes, I could do that. Except they know they can, but he's just a little tougher, a little more psychotic, and a little drunker, and he can do it. But, I mean, those two really epitomize ECW.
To complement the fresh faces, ECW also played host to numerous wrestlers with the Big Two, the WWF and WCW experience. Shane Douglas gave the company an accomplished technical wrestler with star credibility, and he channeled his years of pent-up hostility toward his former associates, Ric Flair and Shawn Michaels in particular, into his always controversial interviews. Too Cold Scorpio of WCW fame became one of the organization's early backbones. Mr. Hughes stopped by for a brief tenure in 1994. Kevin Sullivan collaborated with Heyman on the booking, wrestled for a brief spell, and brought his wife, Woman, into the fold. Dory Funk Jr. wrestled several cards in 94, most notably as part of a feud that pitted him with his brother against Public Enemy. More than anyone else, though, it was Terry Funk who provided ECW with invaluable notoriety. Also, not to mention the notoriety, the selflessness and professionalism that Terry Funk brought was unparalleled in the history of ECW. By working programs with Sabu, the Sandman, and Dreamer, among others, the hardcore guru and former NWA World Champion gave the company's unestablished names legitimacy as stars and a role model whose work ethic they can emulate. The highlight of Eastern Championship Wrestling's itinerary soon became its monthly cards at the 950-seat Viking Hall, eventually about 1600 after a series of capacity upgrades, but initially it was a 950-seat hall that would later be known as the ECW Arena, which began drawing regular sellouts in 1994. The internet was still in its infancy stage, but the audience at these shows were predominantly comprised of fans who read the sheets, had access to the web, and or were otherwise privy to the inner workings of the business. Together, they furnished the promotion's events with a uniquely insider and reverent atmosphere, and they are famous for their popular chants such as, "You effed up," and others when a wrestler botched the spot, "He's hardcore," or "EC dub," after a violent move was performed, and of course, "We want blood," when a given match failed to yield satisfactory gore.
These fans in Philadelphia really, really, really knew their stuff. So you really had to impress, and if you weren't any good, they wouldn't boo you because you're a bad guy. They would boo you out of the building.
The people were so fed up with the same boring rest hold. Everybody grab a chin lock and sit there for 20 minutes.
You know, the chants, you know, before ECW and the crowd and their chants, you never heard that in the crowds.
If someone messed up a move and they started the "you fucked up" chant, whatever it may have been, the fans were like as much a part of that show as anything.
You know, I'd just look around and cover my ears or stomp my feet and they would do it more and it became deafening and it was always like, "She's a crack whore." Or "She's got herpes," or it was all along the lines of the clapping, and they would just, every time I went out there, it would just be the same thing.
The ECW fans, you know what I mean? I had a great relationship with them. I really did, and I just loved them, and they knew I loved them.
Since ECW was like this cult TV show where everybody was watching, that's like where they were as known as the wrestlers, because they had more TV time than anybody.
Rats would come from far and near. Bruh, they be on ice boats coming over the border in Alaska. They be coming out of Africa with a bone in their nose. Oh, bruh, they come. I'm talking about midgets, blind people, everybody, all the rats. I love the rats in Philly. I got credit cards from these rats. I got my room paid for, even though it was already paid for. I would get advance from these rats, but I ain't never paid back to the day. I rent cars for months, and they call me tomorrow. Where am I renting a car? I'd be like, bitch, I don't know.
The fans are the most romanticized things in the history of ECW. Those fans were very, very demanding, and, I mean, they were just assholes at times.
When people know your tricks, they stop buying tickets. Same as a magician. If I know his tricks, I'm not going to watch him but once, maybe once.
When they become part of it, they influence what it is. And I'm talking about the wrestling business or whatever they become part of. And I'm not sure that's always good because it changes the nature of what they liked in the beginning.
Everybody hated it because the fans were so smart that, you know, that they were like, fuck, these guys are dicks. These, you know, they're talking about the fans. Ah, these fans suck. They crap on everything. And so really, it's ironic that the building ended up becoming beloved, but at the time, most of the boys hated it.
They hated me at first. That's the funny part, is they're vicious. They used to make these horrible signs about me and call me Poindexter. And somebody drew a sign about me and there was a jar of Vaseline. It wasn't very nice.
Mick Foley was the first to really act out on that with that whole heel turn that he did, where he was annoyed at the signs, you know, the Kane Dewey signs.
I'm like, you guys don't get it. Those are the best fans because they think they know so much. They're the easiest ones to con.
Showtime at the Apollo in Harlem, they've been known to boo comedians off the stage or boo people into tears. These are the kind of fans you have in Philadelphia in this building. So I'd never seen anything like it.
Damn, they were nuts. I can remember one time I looked out there and I just kind of went like that. And they knew what I wanted, and here came the chairs.
If you could just see it. And look at this. Terry's calling for chairs. Terry's calling for chairs.
Don't throw the fucking chairs. Don't throw the...
Finally, they said, "Funk, do not ever raise your hands like that again and bring them in like that, because the chairs, we cannot have that anymore," because it got to where there'd be 500 chairs come flying into the ring all at once, and it was just that was great, and I don't think you're going to see that again.
I never told them, but they were my favorite fan. Yeah, because they appreciated a good effort, even if you didn't do that good. And they appreciated originality, even if you weren't that good. And they appreciated if you were good, but weren't that big.
They went along with the ride just as much as we rode it.
They should have a reunion, not even for the boys. It should be a rat reunion in Philly. It should be a top 10 question. And out of the top 10 question, one of them would be, you could be a rat from ECW if you stayed at the Holiday Inn on Pecker Avenue. It'd be sold out from the first floor to the 10th, bro. Because, I mean, good God almighty. We used to toss them around there like they were beach balls.
It was the Rocky Horror Picture Show. They knew what point of the movie to throw the popcorn. They knew what point of the movie to, you know, it was just like that. It was an incredible experience. We played off of that. We fed off of it. They fed off of it. It was a synergy between us and the fans.
And that's why I like to think we're the most fan-friendly promotion ever.
Oh, my God. The goddamn arrested. I love you.
In 1993, the roster for ECW was developing. Eddie Gilbert, Doug Gilbert, Kevin Christopher, Samoan Warrior, Paul Diamond, Pat Tanaka, Ivan Koloff, Herb Renesto, Chris Michaels, Hunter Q. Robbins III, Miguelito Perez, Crash the Terminator, Stan Hansen, Chad Austin, The Rockin' Rebel, Todd Shaw, Kevin Sullivan, and Sal Bellomo. Certainly not the hardcore band of misfits that you're familiar with when you chant the letters ECW. Unlike the WWF and WCW, there were no disqualifications in ECW. And as a result, ECW performers naturally took to wielding a fun-filled assortment of defacing foreign objects, including chairs, tables, baseball bats covered in barbed wire, cheese graters, stop signs, pots and pans, even the kitchen sink. Of course, ECW wrestlers also deployed tables and chairs in a variety of innovative positions, Sabu and Public Enemy being the earliest practitioners of the table break. They set the standard for now what we know as to be called table matches. In another case of unparalleled fan participation, the wrestlers frequently solicited assorted weapons from the crowd to use in their matches. My favorite one, of course, was the old original Nintendo system, that big, thick system that we all remember us being 80s kids. The Nintendo system, Legend of Zelda, Mario, all those games that we grew up with, now was a part of a professional wrestling match. I didn't like it for the sheer fact of the violence, but I liked the visualization of grabbing a Nintendo from the crowd to actually use it in a match. The anything-goes atmosphere was conducive to one of the promotion's other distinguishing characteristics. It was basically the fact that, in the traditional sense, it had no clear-cut baby faces and heels. They blurred the lines. I love the black and white cookie. That's one of my favorite cookies, just like Jerry Seinfeld. You have to respect the cookie. Hail to the cookie. But, unfortunately, or maybe in a sense, fortunate to make ECW stand apart from other organizations, you didn't have that black and white side. The lines were blurred. All characters seemed to be a shade of gray. With that being said, although Heyman's booking positioned certain wrestlers to receive cheers and boos in given scenarios, the line between good and bad was virtually non-existent, if only because everyone in the company readily broke all the rules as it was. So, who was really a true good guy, white meat babyface? Not really. Another hallmark of the promotion was its carefully selected, skillfully utilized entrance themes and music videos. At one time or another, ECW wrestlers would enter the ring with the roaring tunes of such major label bands as Guns N' Roses, Metallica, Motorhead, White Zombie, Steppenwolf, Nine Inch Nails, Beck, Offspring, and Ice-T blaring in the background. The loud, often profane, nature of the songs fit perfectly within the vulgar context of the product, while also providing a valuable contrast to the Big Two's largely generic, out-of-touch entrances. Okay, we also must note that for a WWE, WWF, and WCW, the big groups at the time, they're responsible for paying royalties for certain music copyrighted by artists to be broadcasted on their television programs. And due to cost-saving measures, it can be quite expensive when paying out royalties, especially if you're doing it for every superstar. So the big-time companies, especially when they're being broadcast on national television and pay-per-view, they would opt for backing tracks or specific studio themes that were generic, in a sense, when compared to Metallica and Motorhead. Oftentimes, the ever-animated ECW attendees would raucously sing along to the familiar lyrics, particularly to the Sandman's Enter Sandman by Metallica. This would prompt ECW's lead announcer, Joey Styles, to label them as the Sadistic Choir. Plainly, one of the most appealing elements of ECW cards, and particularly those at the ECW Arena, was that they provided a sanctuary for disenchanted WWF and WCW followers. These fans' devotion to ECW was inversely proportional to the quality of the Big Two products. And in 1994, Vince McMahon's and Eric Bischoff's respective standings with the hardcore audience were at near record lows, thus opening the door for ECW. And as a result, there was a backlash from the Big Two, leading into our next part of the series. Ever since Vince McMahon began marketing his gimmicky, work rate deficient vision of wrestling in the mid-80s, more of an entertainment style of wrestling rather than a pure in-ring product, the NWWW had been refuge for more serious devotees of the Mat game, ones who craved a more adult-oriented brand of action. They were the lead groups in professional wrestling at the time. However, never had WCW been less appealing to that variety of fan than in 1994. This is when Hulk Hogan arrived on the scene and obliterated any traces of hardcore-friendly wrestling amenities. WCW separated themselves from the WWF at the time. If you graduated from the WCW 101 series, you know what I'm talking about. WCW was known for being the company to have the pure in-ring talent and pure in-ring content over the spectacle, the grand spectacular entrances and entertainment side, the celebrities of the World Wrestling Federation. But when Hogan came on board in 94, it changed the game in WCW completely. Hogan, who is the antithesis of extreme, began dominating every facet of the company, and he brought with him such anti-hardcore forces such as Hacksaw Jim Duggan, Ed, the Man with a Dozen Names, Leslie, John Avalanche Tenta. Consequently, the Eric Bischoff-led organization suppressed more talented performers like Steve Austin, Cactus Jack, and Brian Pillman. Instead, they opted to conform to every last one of Hogan's whims. A product that wasn't condescending became a thing of the past, as did quality matches, and worst of all, hardcore violence dropped off the Big Two radar. Like the WWF and WCW instituted a ban on bleeding, very similar to what we see today in the WWE's product, the ultimate affront to ECW's temperament was taken away from the mainstream audience, again opening another door for ECW. Although it did feature gifted performers like Bret the Hitman Hart and the Heartbreak Kid Shawn Michaels, the WWF with its clowns and garbage men was no better. Bischoff and McMahon and the out-of-date visions that they promoted were the prime examples of what the hardcore fans hated about professional wrestling, especially at that time. This is what they despised about the wrestling business, and ECW was playing into that hatred with dramatic anti-Big Two overtones. How would ECW go about separating themselves from the prototypical Big Two of the WWF and WCW? Well, a change needed to be made. ECW was a part of the National Wrestling Alliance. They were a so-called affiliate of the big group. At this point in time, as of pretty much today, the NWA is a figurehead. Those three initials embark tradition, which in turn allows them to fulfill a quite large roster of affiliates that are under the NWA banner. These independent promotions are represented, or represent, should I say, the NWA. So if you're affiliated with the NWA, supposedly you would bring that tradition with you. ECW at the time, in 94, was a part of the NWA. A change needed to be made. ECW decided to break tradition and start a brand new extreme tradition of their own. They needed a superstar, a wrestler, an extreme wrestler, to be at the forefront of this movement. Enter the franchise Shane Douglas. On the next chapter of ECW 101, we'll go into the birth of Extreme Championship Wrestling.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Time to thank the sponsors of Beyond the Bell. They help bring this pro wrestling nostalgia podcast to you each and every week. Barbershop Window, the place that makes wrestling t-shirts cool again to wear. They release brand new shirts each and every week. Follow them on Twitter at @bshopwindow and go to barbershopwindow.com now to make your wrestling wardrobe cool again. The SNS Radio Network, your home for pro wrestling, mixed martial arts, and video gaming. Get all the latest news and listen to innovative audio released daily. The network is anchored by the two flagship shows, Wrestling News Live and Sunday Night Showdown. So go to snsradionetwork.com now. If you're not listening, you're not trying. Ringannouncing.com, the home of the future of ring announcing, Sean Beckerman. You can watch the latest videos and demo reels of Sean Beckerman on the independent wrestling scene. Go to ringannouncing.com and follow the future of ring announcing. Combat Zone Wrestling on DVD. Catch the ultra-violent wrestling promotion on TV or on your computer. You can purchase all CZW ultra-violent events on DVD and stream them live straight on your desktop computer at czwrestling.com. Get ready to get ultra-violent with CZW. The National Wrestling Alliance. Tried, tested, honored, and revered. These three initials have represented wrestling since 1948. The NWA has been the breeding ground for the greatest stars in wrestling. You can catch the NWA nationwide through multiple affiliates from coast to coast. The National Wrestling Alliance. Go to nwawrestling.org. Preserving tradition and blazing new paths. If you are interested in becoming a sponsor for Beyond the Bell, send all requests to btbwrestling@gmail.com. Join the Beyond the Bell revolution now. It's go time. WrestleMania season, and it's WrestleMania time here at Beyond the Bell. Last year, the entire month of March was filled with WrestleMania-themed content. This year will be no different. Throughout the month of March, leading into the biggest event of the year for sports entertainment, we will be releasing tons of WrestleMania-themed content. Get ready for Volume 2 of the stories behind WrestleMania, split into three parts where we look back at the previous 28 WrestleManias and the stories behind each and every spectacular event. Get ready to go back in time and learn about the untold stories behind the granddaddy of them all. We will celebrate the 2013 class of the WWE Hall of Fame. Look back at the careers of each inductee and how they made their mark in the world of professional wrestling. And then leading up to the biggest event of the year, you can listen to Beyond the Bell Extra Editions as I will be on site at WrestleMania 29. You will hear audio from myself on site at the location, MetLife Stadium, from the 2013 Hall of Fame in Madison Square Garden, and at WWE Access at the Izod Center, formerly the Meadowlands Arena. All three locations will be there live, on site, and we will give you a first-hand look, or should I say listen, to the sights and sounds of WrestleMania weekend. All this and more during WrestleMania season at Beyond the Bell, starting this March. Get ready, because it's WrestleMania! Chapter 1 of ECW 101 is in the books. Students, The history of Extreme Championship Wrestling has begun. As we close 1992 and 1993, they're in the books. We look ahead to a controversial and monumental year in professional wrestling history, especially in ECW history in 1994. Big things happen in ECW that year. Some say it was the start of the hardcore revolution. This chapter, Chapter 1, served as more so a backdrop, a background of the evolution of ECW, where it came about, and what led to this monumental time in professional wrestling history. Eastern Championship Wrestling is in Philadelphia at this point in time and is about to undergo a huge overhaul to the Extreme. Connect socially to Beyond the Bell on Facebook. Become a fan of Beyond the Bell. Like ring announcer Sean Beckerman. Follow me on Twitter at Sean Beckerman. Go to the official website for Beyond the Bell and your professional ring announcer, your personal ring announcer, Sean Beckerman at ringannouncing.com. The message boards should be open. The forums should be up to post your comments on all things related to retro wrestling and old school sports entertainment. Brand new episodes of Beyond the Bell are released every Monday for you old school fan. You can listen in many ways to Beyond the Bell, whether it's at ringannouncing.com. You could stream it right there from the website. Also, if you have a smartphone, you can use the Stitcher app or TuneIn Radio to listen to Beyond the Bell. There are tons of other podcast apps which you could just search under the name Beyond the Bell, and you can link to BTB every single week and have it automatically downloaded on your smartphone. The two main apps I would suggest for an iPhone would be Downcast or the actual podcast app made through Apple. For Android users, you can go to Google Play and download both the Stitcher and TuneIn Radio apps. You can also download BTB Episode from your browser. And basically, if you're not listening, you're not trying. You know what that means? It's time to go for the three count and take it home with some old school music. We started off the program with Behind the Mic and my opportunity to announce the Sandman to the ring. So why not play the Sandman's theme as our first ECW old school theme of the week here on Beyond the Bell. Enter Sandman by Metallica, one of the most famous, not just ECW themes, but professional wrestling themes in history. And one of the popular. As soon as the initial chords hit that guitar riff, you know stuff is about to happen. The beer-swilling, cane-swinging, hardcore icon, the Sandman, will come either through the audience, down the aisle, walking on ramps or guardrails. He would rock to this theme on every ECW show. So, let's wrap it all up with Metallica, Enter Sandman, here on Beyond the Bell. Until next week, fans, when we rewind and relive all things retro in wrestling, I'm your personal ring announcer, Sean Beckerman, signing off. And I'll see you at the matches.